The centre of Constantinople had been left gutted. Among the many treasures destroyed in the inferno had been the Senate House and all the antique statues with which Constantine had long previously adorned the bathhouse. Their loss had obliterated precious links with what was by now a very distant past. Yet in truth, Justinian was pleased to see them gone. The Senate House had always loomed too large over the Augustaeon for his tastes. Its replacement, so he decreed, was to be built on a much smaller scale. The monuments that Justinian aimed to found upon the rubble of the old would be raised to the glory, not of the traditional gods of the Roman people, but of something very different. A single, omnipotent god.
Tom, who wrote that deathless prose?
It was a top historian.
Was it yourself?
It was. Yes, it was. So that's In the Shadow of the Sword. That is just a summary of where we were at the end of last episode.
Yeah. We're back with Justinian and Theodora, aren't we? Third episode of what was going to be one episode. So for those people who haven't listened to the previous two, obviously you do need to listen. Well, you don't need to, but you could and you should listen to the previous two. We're in the 6th century. We're in Constantinople, the new Rome, the capital of the, well, you call it the Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire. This incredibly glamorous couple are Emperor and Empress, Justinian and Theodora. They have just seen off the Blues and the Greens, the circus factions who were rioting at the beginning of 532. Justinian is rebuilding Hagia Sophia, the great church of the Holy Wisdom, the great cathedral that still is one of the world's great sort of tourist sites in the center of Istanbul. And Tom, Justinian, I mean, the paradox of Justinian, as you say, is that he seems to us to mark a break with ancient Rome, because conventionally, I suppose, in kind of popular history books, in textbooks and encyclopedias and things, the 6th century is roughly the point at which people stop talking of this as the Roman Empire and they start talking of it as the Byzantine Empire. But Justinian has this project, doesn't he, to rebuild not just the city, but to rebuild the Roman world by reuniting Constantinople with Italy and with North Africa and perhaps ultimately with Spain, who knows, with Gaul, with Britain even, with the provinces that have been lost.
Yeah, and I think this is, we talked about, that we ended our last episode on this note, that Justinian is an incredibly paradoxical figure, because on the one hand, he seems almost a bit of an anachronism. He is a kind of Caesar of the order of Trajan. He's a great conqueror. He's the embodiment of these kind of ancient Roman martial imperial traditions. But at the same time, his attempts to kind of restore this Roman Empire actually precipitates its decline.
Yeah. Well, that's the big argument, isn't it, about whether that's the case. But actually, when it starts, so he starts with North Africa, doesn't he? That's his first target. And it's been run by these, I mean, it's been taken over by these people called the Vandals for about 100 years. And actually, that campaign goes pretty well. The Vandals, interestingly, we haven't talked as much as some people might expect about Christological disputes in these novels. But the Vandals are yet another brand of heretics, because they are Arians, aren't they? So they believe, now, Tom, I know you'll think this is a grotesque simplification, but am I right in thinking the Vandals believe that Jesus is subordinate to God?
Basically, yes. He's not co-eternal with God.
He's not quite as good.
And so we, in the first episode, we talked about these kind of rows about the nature of Christ, and the Arian heresy that the Vandals hold to is a product of the 4th century, the age of Constantine. So in that sense, the Vandals are, you know, they're throwbacks. They're theological throwbacks.
Crikey. They're dinosaurs.
They are, So they've clearly, you know, they've got to be cleared up. The Vandals are doubly a threat, because they're occupying the breadbasket that had previously fed Rome. They're occupying the great Roman city of Carthage. But also they hold to this kind of antiquated heresy, and it's unacceptable. So Justinian raises an immense fleet, a great armada. It sails out from the harbor of Constantinople to much cheering. And it's a triumphant success, and it's under the command of Belisarius, who people who listened to the previous episode may remember is very much in Justinian's good books, because he's slaughtered thousands of people in the Hippodrome.
The equivalent of loads of unarmed football hooligans.
Yes. Basically. Exactly, yes.
But so actually, when you look at the timeline, I mean, the fleet leaves in the midsummer 533, so that's just over a year and a bit since the end of the rioting. But actually, they pretty much wiped the floor with the Vandals within less than a year. So the king of the Vandals is a man called Gelimer. Do you know what happened to Gelimer, Tom?
He gets taken back, doesn't he? And led in triumph.
So he was beaten at a battle. Gelimer went and hid. And Belisarius said, you know, will you surrender? And he said, yes. And do you know what he asked for in return? I'm so delighted I found these details.
It was so plausible. Remind me.
He said, I require just two things to get me to surrender. They were a sponge and a lyre. The sponge was to wipe his eye because he suffered an eye infection while in hiding. And the lyre was Gelimer had written a song. He'd written a dirge because he felt very downbeat after losing his kingdom. And he said, I'd like a lyre so that I could try it out.
So Belisarius gave him that.
So he gave him the sponge and the lyre. He was taken to Constantinople and he was led in a triumph. So yes. That's very Roman, Tom.
Unbelievably Roman.
Yeah.
So this great triumph that kind of culminates in the Hippodrome.
And he retired. Gelimer retired. He was allowed to retire to Galatia. Galatia is now in Turkey, I think, is it?
Yeah, so it's kind of middle of Cappadocia.
Almost. So is he in danger of getting a letter from St. Paul? Didn't St. Paul write to the, yes. Did he write to the Galatians?
Yes he did.
So am I right in thinking, therefore, the Vandal rule in Africa must have been relatively kind of shallow?
Yeah, pretty much. They were disliked by the people that they ruled.
Is that because they're basically a bunch of Germans kind of sweating in
they're a bunch of Vandals, aren't they?
African sun.
The dark reputation that they have is reflected in the fact that we still use the word Vandal to mean what it means. So, and the story is that they took the looted treasures from Jerusalem that Titus had brought in the first century, paraded it through in his triumph through the streets of Rome, that the Vandals then took it to Carthage, and Belisarius then takes them to Constantinople, is one of the story. We're not absolutely sure about that, but it's, you know, if that's true, it's kind of a nice sense in the way.
It's a very good story.
You know, these are the trophies of victory. And Justinian could legitimately say, well, you know, Rome is back. We're celebrating triumphs. And of course, the next target is the big one, which is Italy and Rome.
But that's a different matter, isn't it? So Italy has been run by the Goths, the Ostrogoths. Theodoric, who had been the great Gothic leader, had sort of been subordinate to Constantinople. Am I right? He'd sort of acknowledged the kind of suzerainty of the emperor in Constantinople.
Yeah, so there's a kind of spacious legalism whereby the emperor could pretend that he still ruled Italy, and the Ostrogoths could feel that they had that they'd been legitimized, that they weren't just kind of barbarians.
Yeah.
And Italy under Theodoric is a pretty stable, prosperous place. So they are, you know, the Senate is still sitting in Rome. Chariots are still being raced in the Circus Maximus. Water is flowing happily along the aqueducts. So, you know, there are lots of people. I think we mentioned this in the episode we did on when the Roman Empire falls, that there are lots of people in Italy who don't particularly feel that the Roman Empire has fallen.
Yeah.
And to that extent, the arrival of a large flotilla from Constantinople isn't necessarily greeted with kind of rapturous enthusiasm, because it means that Italy will now become a theatre of war.
Well, I was going to ask about this, because we could do a sort of Dan Carlin hardcore history style narrative of the Italian wars. I studied these when I was a student. And when I used to read Procopius's account of the wars in Italy, I found it absolutely impossible to keep awake, let alone work out what was going on. But basically, to cut a really, really long story very, very simplistically short, the campaign just lasts forever. And within a year of landing, so Belisarius is in charge yet again. He captures Naples. But within a year of landing, he's basically holed up in Rome, isn't he? He's got into Rome.
So Belisarius famously is the first person to capture Rome from the south before the Allies in the Second World War.
So your brother has written a book about the war in Italy in the Second World War. And I was struck because everyone always says, you know, the war in Italy is sort of the forgotten part of the Second World War, because it was so vicious and so difficult for the Allies fighting their way up the peninsula against the Germans. And there's a bit of an element of that about this, isn't there?
A bit, yeah.
They've had a sort of a soft start in North Africa, and now they land in Italy, and it's just so much more difficult. And yeah, Belisarius does capture Rome, but then he ends up...
He loses it, gets it back. Yeah. And this is essentially what finishes Rome off as a great capital. Because during the course of all these kind of sieges and so on, the aqueducts get cut. And without the aqueducts, it becomes impossible to sustain the size of population that Rome had had. And at one point during these wars, Rome effectively becomes depopulated. Yeah. So the city that at the heyday of the empire had a million, you know, it's this absolute wilderness. It's this emptied wilderness.
I mean, that's true of much of Italy, isn't it? That the farmlands are destroyed by these armies crisscrossing back and forth. You get accounts of people starving. It must have been a kind of apocalyptic landscape.
Completely. And, you know, thanks first to Belisarius and then to Narses, who by this point is about 310.
Yeah.
So he takes over the command. They effectively get control of Italy, but it's, you know, it's a charnel house. And if you want to say, well, when does the Roman Empire end in Italy? I'd say it's with this.
I mean, I know it's impossible to say, but is it your sense that most people in Italy would have much preferred the, in inverted commas, Roman army never to have pitched up and to just lived quite happily under Gothic rule?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, if you're a senator in Rome, and you end up a penniless refugee, it's no consolation that you are now ruled by an emperor from a Caesar in Constantinople.
Yeah, of course.
And the worst thing is that, you know, from the point of view of the penniless senator, is that it's all for nothing, because very soon after the conquests have seemingly been completed and the Goths defeated, a whole new people in the form of the Lombards turn up and grab, you know, huge chunks of Italy, so that Constantinople ends up ruling Rome still. So it still has Rome, and it has Ravenna, because Ravenna is a port that is open to shipping coming up the Adriatic.
And Ravenna had been a previous imperial capital as well, hadn't it?
It had, yes. And so there are lots of palaces there. There are lots of churches there. It had been pretty much the capital for Ostrogothic rule. And it will become the place where the most famous visual representations of Justinian
Theodora. Well, this is what I was about to say, Tom, that the wars, from a tourist's perspective, from a modern tourist perspective, the wars were tremendously worthwhile, because these extraordinary visual depictions of Justinian and Theodora survive in the church of, I think it's San Vitale, isn't it, in Ravenna. I mean, they are the most incredible Byzantine mosaics. But, you know, that brings us slightly back to the personalities of Justinian and Theodora, which I guess sometimes get lost in this story, because we have images of them that we don't have, really, of most other post-6th century emperors and certainly empresses. I guess, do you think that's one reason why, another reason why Theodora is, I mean, nobody really remembers barely any, maybe Zoe later on.
Irene,
but apart from that, nobody remembers other empresses. Do you think that the existence of the mosaics is one reason why?
Yes, I'm sure, because, you know, the literal iconography of it.
Yeah.
It's so powerful. And they're such kind of stunning mosaics. They're such kind of, you know, they're on the cover of every book about... Not just Justinian Theodora, but about pretty much Byzantium.
Well, I think because they're completely worth it and a tremendous idea, because they gave us the mosaics that we can advertise this podcast with. However, just after they've embarked, really, I mean, within a year or a couple of years of embarking on this reconquest of Italy, there's trouble in the East. So we've talked in previous episodes about Persia being the big, you know, the big superpower threat to Constantinople, and Khosrow as sort of, is he Khrushchev to Justinian's Kennedy, or is he Kennedy to Justinian's Khrushchev? I don't know who quite fits that analogy. I mean, Justinian is a peasant stock, isn't he? So maybe he's Khrushchev, and Khosrow is a very regal stock, so maybe he's Kennedy. Anyway, the Persians reappear, come across the frontier, and they basically capture Antioch,
which is the third city. So it's in Syria. It's the great capital of Syria. Very ancient city, very rich city. So it's a disaster.
So Procopius says, "I become dizzy as I write of such a great calamity." And that must have been how many people in Constantinople felt when they contemplated the fact. I mean, it's a problem for them that Antioch is not that far from the border, I suppose. And, and as you say, there's no as you said in previous episodes, there are no real natural frontiers between Rome and Persia, so that the Persians can just, you know, if they spot a weakness, they can just pile across. But this is a colossal setback for Justinian. Surely a bigger setback than the capture of some of Italy is a triumph, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. It's a humiliation and it's a stunning blow to the economy of the empire.
Yeah.
You know, to have your third city, to have all the, you know, the skilled people, all the craftsmen and everybody, they all get taken off to Iraq and Persia. The city is stripped bare. It's complete humiliation and a disaster.
And as if one disaster like that wasn't enough,
okay.
We are a year away from the arrival in, I think it's first detected in Egypt.
In Pelusium. So we talked about this with Kyle last week. So it comes to the plague arrives, hits Pelusium, hits Alexandria, winnows out from Alexandria to Constantinople and then to Italy and then onwards, westwards and eastwards. So it hits Persia as well. Absolute disaster. I mean, there is much debate about the scale of it, but I think we're with Peter Saris on this, aren't we? This is a disaster on the scale of the Black Death, pretty much.
So Procopius says, I mean, obviously we did talk about this in our podcast with Karl Harper, but just to kind of recapitulate for those people who missed it, I mean, Procopius says 10,000 people a day died in Constantinople. And because Procopius clearly tends to exaggerate, and because he also did think Justinian's head floated off its body and could reappear. So people sort of say, 10,000, it couldn't have been 10,000. He probably means it was 500. But I think a lot of historians now would say, I mean, you mentioned Peter Saris, who's written articles about this. A lot of historians now would say, Procopius is probably right. It probably does kill thousands of people a day. It probably kills tens of millions of people across the Mediterranean.
Justinian himself gets it and is one of the few that survives. So many people are dying in the streets of Constantinople that they start chucking them in the harbour, and then it just blocks up the harbour because it's just floating with corpses. So Justinian orders that they should dig pits on the other side of the Golden Horn, so across from the kind of promontory on which Constantinople is built. And they dig these pits and they chuck the bodies in. And there are these hideous descriptions of how the corpses kind of melt and come to constitute a kind of corpse custard, I suppose, a thick gravy. So that if you drop, you know, if somebody falls into it, they get kind of sucked down into the mulch of it.
Oh my word.
And drown. I mean, it's so hideous.
I mean,
and so
if you're going to drown, don't drown in human gravy.
No, I mean, it's just really horrible. And when you get chroniclers kind of saying, as one does, that the whole of humanity came close to annihilation, of course that's an exaggeration. So people say that kind of language, it's bred of the Bible. You know, it's equivalent of a kind of, you know, a Daily Mail headline, YOY, terrible for house prices, all this kind of thing.
Let me just be absolutely clear in case anybody's listening in Rothermere Towers. There's absolutely nothing wrong with Daily Mail headlines. They are very measured and sober.
Okay.
And I want to go on absolutely on record as distancing myself from that shameful remark.
So if the Daily Mail's ran, it would say this is going to be terrible for house prices. But I think it is, you know, the apocalyptic quality of it is really very, very profound. And I think that it's an absolute disaster for Justinian and his plans, because what it does is that it demolishes his tax base.
Yes.
And it means that the funds to pay his armies, to maintain the roads, to maintain the fortifications that line the frontiers along, say, the Danube or along Syria, are gone. And that has catastrophic implications for the stability of the empire, because it means that you know, nomads are likelier to escape the impact of the plague. It's urban centers that are being hit by it, and that is, in the very long run, you know, that's very bad news, because it means that the Arabs will be able to move in. But in the short term, it means that bands of horsemen are able to cross the Danube, you know, rather as the Lombards do, going into Italy, and they discover that there's no one to stop them.
Just on Justinian and the plague, Tom. Justinian is ill for weeks, and he almost dies. He's not a young man. He became emperor when he was in his 40s. So now he is what? He's in his, he must be nearly 60.
Yeah, he's getting on.
So he's lucky to pull through. And there's obviously must have been talk when he's lying you know, who's going to be next? Who's going to succeed him? And clearly, he has one general who's a sort of dashing, swashbuckling general, very good at fighting hooligans in stadiums, but also very good at beating vandals and giving them sponges, and that is Belisarius. And it's about this point, isn't it, that you start to really notice that his favorite general, you know, they're no longer on such great terms, and that basically probably Justinian is worried that Belisarius wants to replace him, that he's a focus for opposition, you know, that let's get rid of the old man and get the young guy in. And do you think this, that Justinian's near-death experience is one of the things that explains their falling out that Robert Graves writes about in his novel?
I doubt it.
You don't think so?
No, I think Justinian was a naturally suspicious person.
You're so down on Justinian, Tom. Very bad, very bad.
Well, I mean, he was a disaster. I mean, he was a disaster. And I think I think we should take a break at this point. And when we come back, we should end this account of his reign and that of Theodora by looking at the death of Theodora, looking at the last years of Justinian's rule, and then looking at Procopius and saying, well, you know, where is his secret history coming from? What's the...
Okay, very good. We will see you after the break. Bye-bye. This man was both an evildoer and easily led into evil, the sort of person whom they call a moral pervert, never of his own accord speaking the truth to those with whom he conversed, but having a deceitful and crafty intent behind every word. He was insincere, crafty, hypocritical, dissembling his anger, double-dealing, clever, a perfect artist in acting out an opinion which he pretended to hold, and even then able to produce tears, not from joy or sorrow, but contriving them for the occasion, according to the needs of the moment. Always playing false. So that's one of the members of our Rest His History Club talking about my co-presenter, Tom Holland. And if you too want to join the Rest His History Club, join up at resthishistorypod.com. So no other podcast, I think, in the world, Tom, uses the words of the historian Procopius to recruit supporters for their own podcast club. So I think that's something that distinguishes us from other history podcasts.
Yes, and continuing that Procopian tradition of 1 minute being all smiles and nice and kind and generous, and then suddenly stabbing me in the back.
Well, you know what Procopius said?
Very Procopian behavior.
He was a fickle friend, a truceless enemy, an ardent devotee of assassination and of robbery. There was no robbery in the Rest Is History Club. Let's be absolutely clear about that. Right, Tom.
The lessons of history.
So we've done the plague. We have done the incredibly grueling campaign in Italy, which has been grinding all this time. We've done the fact that Justinian has suffered this terrible, devastating humiliation of the sack of Antioch by the Persians. And Theodora in all this, I mean, she's sort of like a lot of women in history. She's invisible to the chroniclers if they're not slagging her off, isn't she? But we kind of know one thing about her, which is that she, I mean, Procopius basically says he presents it in a very bad light. She clearly tried to rehabilitate lots of prostitutes. So she housed them in a convent. Procopius basically says,
yes, called repentance.
Yes, she incarcerated these ladies of the night against their will, this dreadful harridan. But clearly there's a kind of Gladstonian way of looking at that.
Yeah, completely. Completely. And she kind of makes Justinian into a rather improbable feminist. So he introduces a lot of legislation to kind of improve women's lives.
Yeah.
Clearly influenced by Theodora.
Divorce reform, mothers getting custody, the end of the death penalty for women who've been accused of being unfaithful, the death penalty for rape. He brings in. So lots of things that clearly, you know, you have this image of this sort of Bill and Hillary Clinton kind of relationship where.
Yeah.
And she also has the latitude to support bishops and missionaries and things with her own kind of Monophysite beliefs, doesn't she? So she clearly is a...
Although the Orthodox tradition comes to be that actually she was Orthodox all along and that she was a kind of Trojan horse.
So is that how she was able to become a saint, basically?
It is, yes. Yeah.
But do you think, Tom, that... do you think she was, as it were, a saintly figure? I mean,
yes,
should we remember her as a...
I always think that about people who are described as being saintly by hagiographers.
Yeah.
And the temptation is always to say, oh, it was all just a sham, it was all just a fraud. I have no doubt that Theodora's you know, her process of being born again, if you want to put it like that, in Alexandria as a young woman, when she turns her back on her previous career, I'm sure that's absolutely authentic. And, you know, the obvious reason for thinking that is that Justinian, whatever else you may say about him, is, you know, he's not a hypocrite. He really does believe what he says he believes.
Yeah.
And his Christian faith is crucially, crucially important to him. And so it's inconceivable that he would marry and love a woman who was a dissembler.
Right, because there's nothing in it for him in marrying her.
Nothing.
I mean, he actually has to, I mean, as we discussed in a previous podcast, his uncle has to change the law to allow him to,
yeah,
to marry beneath his station.
So they are a great Christian couple. I mean, no question about that.
One might say, Tom, is if she does have this shady past, which we'll come to in a second, the allegations against her, if she does have this very shady past, then it's all the more impressive that she devotes her energies to rehabilitating girls who've been sex slaves, girls who've been prostitutes.
Yeah.
Because, of course, that draws attention to her. I mean, she's not afraid to draw attention to her past, is she? Because she's not trying to distance herself.
So Procopius says, and there's, I think, no reason to doubt it, because there is a Monophysite bishop who refers to Theodora without any kind of, you know, just absolutely naturally, that Theodora, who was in a brothel. Yeah. So it's not something that the Monophysites, who see her as her great champion, are trying to hide. They acknowledge it. And they see it as redounding to her credit. So we mentioned Mary Magdalene, that this is an example. But and it's so difficult, because to get into the minds of people from such a distant culture, such a distant time. But that opening passage that we read in the very first, you know, the opening of part one.
The geese.
That passage has always been a subject of kind of, you know, titillation and salaciousness. But what her career there, she is a child. So she's a child. She's being introduced, you know, she's performing these acts as a child, and she's starting to be prostituted as you know, by our standards, underage.
Well, there's descriptions of her. I mean, Procopius is completely upfront about that. He says she was too immature to sleep with a man or to have intercourse like a woman, but she acted as might a male prostitute to satisfy those dregs of humanity, slaves though they were, who followed their master to the theatre and there took the opportunity to indulge in such bestial practices. He's telling that story to say how degenerate she is. Of course, we read that story and we say, oh my God, she is a child sex slave.
And so Procopius, with that kind of language, is doing what Roman moralists have always done, which is to blame the victims of prostitution and slavery for the crimes that are forced on them, the rapes that are forced on them, and to say, well, they love it, they enjoy it, they're absolutely rapacious, they, you know, they're insatiable.
Yeah.
That's an absolute, you know, so in that sense, Procopius, as in so many other things, is an absolute traditionalist. And I think that it is not, it's not anachronistic to adopt a perspective that says, well, you know, that is a crime, because our perspective is the Christian perspective, essentially, that every individual should have bodily integrity.
Yeah.
And so I think there is a sense in which Theodora is, you know, her Christianity is the way that she tries to reform prostitutes, that she tries to bring in laws that will better patrol the right of women not to be raped, is expressed, you know, it's a part of this process that Justinian is also very much the embodiment of, where traditions that have been inherited from Rome are starting to be swept away by an increasingly Christian worldview.
Yeah, in a sense that she's not trying to distract attention from her sin. She knows she's been a sinner, as it were, but she's also been a victim, and she's not afraid. There is, as you've often said about Christianity, the great innovation of Christianity is that there is, as it were, dignity and holiness in suffering, in being a victim, which the Romans had never believed, had they?
Yeah.
And all of this brings us to the question of, I mean, she dies, poor old Theodora, she dies of probably, I mean, I don't know where people get this from, where they guess how people died, but everything that you ever read says she probably died of cancer in 548. So she died at the age of, in her late 40s, probably.
There was a church in which Constantine and other emperors had been buried. And Justinian, in his grief, builds a new kind of mausoleum in which she's laid. And whenever he rode past it, he would stop and light candles before her grave. So his bereavement was clearly very real. Theodora was clearly, you know, to the end of their days, they loved each other. I don't think it's being sentimental or anachronistic to say that. And she was clearly, you know, the great partner that he'd missed terribly in the kind of rather grim final years of his life.
But the sort of tragedy for her, Tom, is that everybody remembers, I mean, those people who do remember her for the geese. And they remember Procopius. Now, he was, to explain to who he was basically Belisarius's secretary, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. So he's from Palestine. He sees, you know, a lot of what he's describing. And as well as the secret history, he also writes a book about the monuments that Justinian raises.
With a brilliant title, On Buildings.
On Buildings. and he writes a history of the war. So he writes a history of the North African War, the Vandal War, and the conquest of Italy, in which he is very, very respectful of Justinian.
There's none of the stuff about moral perversion and, you know, or demons' heads and shapeless masses of flesh in that.
Yeah. And so in these histories of the Italian wars, you know, he gives Justinian a very good spin. So he says of Justinian that he took over the state when it was much harassed by disorder. And his achievement was that not only did he make it greater in extent, but also much more illustrious. So in the history of the wars, Procopius is the spokesman for Justinianic propaganda.
Yeah.
And so the question has always been, what on earth is he doing? Doing, you know, one of the great kind of literary assassinations of all time. So that, as you said, whenever people think of Theodora, they don't think of the saint. They think of the geese.
Yeah, and the gymnastics. But isn't this simply, I mean, very easily explained, that Justinian and Theodora have fallen out with Belisarius and his wife, Antonina? There's all kinds of weird stuff about Theodora and Antonina kind of plotting against each other and gossiping and all this sort of very Rebecca Vardy and Colleen Rooney. And the Procopius is writing because he's, you know, he's Belisarius's partisan.
But he's equally rude about Belisarius.
He's just bitter, isn't he? He's just generally bitter.
I mean, he's slagging them off as well. I think what is going on is that Procopius is a conservative.
Mm.
And essentially, you know, that is what Romans were. You know, I mean, it's insane to talk about Roman conservatives because everyone was conservative. Everyone had this kind of deep-seated assumption that the old ways were the best. Justinian, again, is a Christian to the extent that he is dreaming of a new and better world. It's a new and better world in which he is the autocrat, but he is a radical. He is a revolutionary to that extent. He wants to reshape the world, even if he's saying, well, by reshaping the world and improving it, I'm also, you know, restoring and repairing what's gone wrong.
Yeah.
And Procopius, in The Secret History, the thing he goes on and on and on about is that Justinian is constantly, he's deliberately setting out to mess everything up. This is what's giving him his great source of pleasure. He's going around ruining everything, changing everything, messing everything up.
Yeah.
And I think for Procopius, genuinely, he thinks that Justinian is a demonic figure because he can't really understand ultimately, firstly, how he's got power, and secondly, why he's using this power to such disastrous ends as Justinian sees it. And one of the ways in which you can see how this preys on Procopius's mind is that although we said that the history of the wars is much more overtly positive, there's a passage where the Goths send ambassadors to Khosrow, the king of Persia, to try and persuade him to launch an invasion of the Roman Empire while the Romans are busy invading Italy. And the Gothic ambassador says of Justinian that he is a man who by nature strives for change and loves what do not belong to him at all, who is not able to keep things as they are, who has therefore tried to seize the whole earth and has been captured by the desire to take for himself each and every rule. And you compared Justinian to Khrushchev. I mean, you know, the Goths there are kind of casting Justinian as an agent of universal change and revolution and upheaval. And I think, that Procopius is putting in the Gothic ambassador's mouth what he feels about Justinian.
Yeah, and that sounds very plausible.
I think he genuinely does see him as a demonic figure.
Even though, of course, the irony is that Justinian thinks he is, reviving the glory of Rome. So what to some people seems a radical project, and you could argue, I mean, we'll come to this in a second, you could argue is a moment of tremendous disruption from which the Roman world never recovers. Justinian conceives of that as a restorative project. That's why some historians talk about this as a reconquista, as a kind of, even though actually it's a good analogy, because of course the reconquista is not really a reconquest because those territories never belonged to Spain. So Justinian's so-called reconquista probably doesn't seem like a reconquest to people in Italy who'd probably much rather be off living under the Goths without armies trudging over their farmland.
Justinian is doing it for what he sees as the very noblest of motives. He's doing it as a Roman and he's doing it as a Christian. And he sees, you know, these are the duties that have been laid on him by God. Where Procopius is, I think, scabrously unfair to Justinian is in saying that Justinian is doing it just for the fun of it.
Yeah.
So Procopius says of Justinian that he wasn't satisfied just with ruining the Roman Empire. So in other words, the territories that he already owned, and that this is why he insisted on invading North Africa, why he insists on invading Italy. It's for the sole purpose of ensuring that he can destroy the inhabitants of those lands as well as the inhabitants of the Roman Empire.
It's just a ludicrous thing to say.
But I think probably Procopius genuinely believes that the forces of evil have been unleashed on the earth because I think that the scale of the plague and the war.
I was just going to ask you about that.
So monstrous that I think, you know, this is an age where you're living in apocalyptic times.
I mean, Justinian, so Theodora died in 548. Justinian, although he's a fair bit older than her, he lives for another 17 years, which I think, you know, when historians talk about it, he feels like an aging, exhausted, everything's a bit grayer. I mean, obviously, it's not surprising it feels like a sort of grayer time, because it's in the aftermath of this horrendous plague, constant sort of fighting. It's very clear, isn't it, Tom, that he's, you know, their tax base has shrunk, their manpower has shrunk, they're struggling to fight off incursions on the frontiers. So at one point, there's a group called the Cutrigurs who make it all the way down into Greece, sort of charging around Greece, you know, sort of sacking and pillaging. And you've also got the first rumors of a group of people called the Avars, who are going to be a big issue for Constantinople in the long run. So it's quite a sort of grim, grey story, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think that it is a genuinely tragic story, if by tragedy you mean, you know, someone is destroyed by his own qualities and virtues.
Well, let's get to it. So Justinian dies in November 565. He'd ruled for almost 40 years. He's succeeded by his nephew, Justin, who becomes Justin II. And then you have a couple more emperors before you really get to the kind of, as it were, the cataclysm.
Yeah.
So to sort of jump ahead and anticipate, to paint the picture for people who are not massively familiar with this, at the end of the 6th century, beginning of the 7th century, the Roman-Persian conflict becomes this kind of all-out superpower death match, where the Persians appear to have the Romans completely on the ropes. And a new emperor called Heraclius sort of summons up every last sinew of Roman energy and fights them off. And they're both absolutely exhausted. And it's at this point that the Arabs appear and absolutely wipe the floor with them.
And people who want to know what happens then, we have done an episode on Muhammad, which I commend to you.
So Tom,
if you want to follow this story up, that's the next stage in this story.
So Tom, there are two ways of looking at Justinian and Theodora and their time in that light, I would say. One would be to say, this is the last hurrah for a particular kind of Rome before the deluge. And to say, you know what, there's quite a big interval between Justinian's death and the coming of Islam. It's ridiculously unfair to blame him for something that happens so long afterwards. He did his best to restore the Roman state. It's not massively unstable. I mean, it's fiscally fragile, but it's not massively unstable when he dies. Actually, he is a pretty great emperor. He reasserts the dignity of the office. He reasserts the authority of the capital, all of those things. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation would be to say he massively overextends the empire. He wastes a lot of money on campaigns in North Africa and Italy that don't really achieve anything. It takes 20 years to subdue Italy. You know, he, because of the overextension, in the long run, he lands his successors with commitments that are unsustainable. And it's basically his fault that it all goes wrong a generation later. I'm guessing that you're in the first camp.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're not?
I think his campaigns in Italy are disastrous, as I said, for anything that would rank as a kind of the continuity of Roman civilization in Italy.
Yeah.
I think they are so destructive. But I think the real villain isn't Justinian. I think it's Yersinia Pestis, which is why I wanted to do this in the wake of the discussion that we had with Karl
Harper. So by that, you mean the plague?
I mean the plague. So I think that without the plague, I think it is entirely possible to see the situation in Italy stabilizing, Roman military power in Italy becoming sufficient that the Lombards never invade, the Danube frontier holds, Antioch is, you know, has been demolished by Khosrow, but it could, you know, this has happened before. Antioch is always being demolished either by Persians or by earthquakes. So that frontier could be stabilized, and you would never have had, you know, because the whole reason, the whole thing why the plague is so devastating relative to nomads is that it's urban centers that get destroyed, and people out in the desert, you know, are able to maintain their forces. It's that ultimately in the long run kind of dooms the Roman control of Syria, of Palestine, of Egypt. Yeah. So I think without the plague, well, I mean, maybe, you know, maybe the Roman Empire would still be a going concern. who knows? But I think the reputation of Justinian would be very different. And I think that he could have spent his last decades, rather than frantically struggling to repair the damage inflicted by the plague, in, you know, restoring prosperity to Italy, restabilizing the frontier along with Mesopotamia. I think the story would have been very different. And I think the Balkan frontier wouldn't have collapsed as it does.
Yes.
You wouldn't have had barbarians kind of penetrating all the way to Greece, all the way to the walls of Constantinople. I think the story would have been very different. And with Italy stabilized, of course, the Romans would then be in a position to start thinking about recapturing maybe southern Gaul, the Provincia, you know, very kind of Romanized area, and expanding the toeholds that they do get in southern Spain. So I think the story could have been very different. I think, you know, it's right to call the plague that hits the Mediterranean in the 6th century the Justinianic plague, because he is the paradigmatic ruler of the age. But it's also kind of, you know, it's a cruel irony, because it is the Justinianic plague that destroys Justinian's legacy.
Although as it stands, Tom, he leaves a not unimpressive legacy. I mean, he codifies the laws. Mm-hmm. He doesn't see
Hagia Sophia, the architecture of.
He leaves the most famous. Some of the, not. Yeah. I mean, his reign leaves these tremendous buildings, the mosaics, the art. He doesn't see color. You know, there's not massive civil wars and rebellions during his reign. I mean, riots,
apart from the Nica
riots. Right, the riots in the Hippodrome is very famous, but by the standards of Roman rebellions, you know, it's all done and dusted in what, a week, and limited to the capital. So you could say, you know, of the Roman emperors in this period, he is by far the most
visionary,
the most adept at using the machinery of government. The one who has, you know, visionary is the right word. The one who has the clearest vision for a renovated and reformed, modernized empire, and it doesn't work through factors that he can't control.
I think, though, the tragedy is that vision runs into
reality,
the greatest natural calamity to hit the Mediterranean. For, you know, and that's why I think it was right to do these series of episodes, because they have been prefaced by that episode we did with Karl Harper on the way that plague impacted the Roman world.
We've talked ever since we started this whole podcast, The Rest is History, about the Byzantine Empire and Byzantium. Do you think this is the moment at which it no longer makes sense for us as historians looking back to talk about Rome? So in other words, is the word Roman still useful to describe the people who call themselves Romans in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th centuries? Or do you think Justinian's reign and the period that then immediately follows it marks such a break that they're no longer usefully Romans?
I think a more useful point is the Arab,
the coming of Islam,
invasions, conquests, because I think what had been the Roman Empire basically gets reduced to a rump. You know, that great legacy of cities that the emperors in Constantinople had inherited from the Greek and the Roman classical worlds, they get destroyed essentially.
Yeah.
So all that really gets left is Constantinople, and the people of Constantinople did call themselves Byzantine. So they called themselves Roman, they were Romaeoi, but they did also call themselves Byzantines. The extent that what had been the Roman Empire, you know, at one point basically is Constantinople with a few kind of scattered territories that are constantly being invaded by Arabs and barbarians from the north. I think the Byzantine conveys the sense of a really radical break. I think that Justinian's rule is very decisive as a kind of fracture point, but it's a kind of evolution of norms in Rome that someone like Procopius can see as a kind of shocking assault. But Procopius is kind of talking about it as a political process.
Yeah.
What happens with the Arab invasions is, you know, almost the entire collapse of the empire, and essentially the effort of ensuring that Constantinople doesn't fall, that something in Anatolia, in Greece, in the Balkans, and to a degree in Italy, is preserved, is so shattering and exhausting that by the time the Byzantine Empire starts to get back on a moderately stable footing, everything has changed. And you have people in Constantinople who look at what has remained of the Roman era, you know, the statues, the friezes, even the great statue of Justinian that he's put up to himself. And they can't remember what, you know, who or what these things are. Yeah. They think that they're kind of illustrations of necromancers and there are no histories. That's the other thing. So Procopius is kind of the last of that living tradition that reaches all the way back to Thucydides and Herodotus.
Mm.
But it's the measure of the, you know, we talked about this with Karl Harper. I think it's a measure of the trauma that they suffer, that people aren't around to write histories. So there really is a break, I think.
Well, and I think we should do future episodes on the Arab conquests and Byzantium's resilience, and of course, iconoclasm, which is a particularly mysterious and intriguing moment in Byzantine history.
Quite topical.
And very topical. And on current form, Tom, we'll probably get around to doing those in about 2027.
Yes.
So
we'll see you in 2027.
But there's one last question before we end, which I think is the question that will have been on a lot of listeners' minds since we started the first of these Justinian and Theodora podcasts, what seems like an eternity ago. And that is this, Tom, do you think Theodora was a justified victor of Love Island?
I really do. And I think that so Love Island in Britain finished last week.
Love Island finished about a month ago.
So Theodora is a kind of Love Island contestant who then ends up the most powerful woman in Britain.
Yeah.
That gives you some measure, I think, of her quality.
The most powerful woman in Britain.
Yes,
yeah, so, I see you're saying, yeah, that's the analogy. Yeah,
imagine that. And you, I think, have some sense of the fact that clearly she was, she combined charisma, sex appeal, intelligence, ruthlessness, and ultimately holiness in a package that I think is entirely inimitable.
Well, I'll end with this thought, Tom, that if Theodora had been married to Stanley Baldwin, her co-champion on Love Island, rather than Justinian, Stanley Baldwin's mantra, of course, was safety first. And it may well be that the Roman Empire would still be going today had Stanley Baldwin been in charge in the 6th century. And that is a thought you probably won't have heard on any rival history podcast, but I imagine we'll live with our listeners till the end of their days.
If only it had been Stanley and Theodora.
Yeah, if only Stanley Baldwin had been Roman Emperor in 527, history would be very different. And on that bombshell... thank you, Tom. That was an absolutely splendid. I really enjoyed that. I don't know if our listeners enjoyed it, but I certainly enjoyed it. We will see you next time for all kinds of treats. What have we got coming, Tom? We've got Lady Jane Grey. We've got
The real outbreak of the Second World War, haven't we? We've got holidays.
Yeah, holidays.
Lots of
Roman holidays, Victorian holidays. Since it is the holiday season. And looking further forward, we've got Walt Disney and we've got French films and we've got the Norse myths.
Yes, history of France told through 10 French films.
So yeah.
So lots to come.
All sorts of delights. And we will see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.